last Sunday, and I was here, I invited you to consider making this the year of something. And I said that for myself, I had made this the year of return and reflection. And just curious, for those of you here last week, did any of you choose to make this the year of something for you? Excellent. Happy to see that. It's already proving useful to me as my year's a little slow getting started because I have spent the whole week since I last saw you involved in this multi-institution teacher training, meditation retreat teacher trainer, which where you're this group of people are trained to teach retreats from a weekend retreat to a mini-month retreat, and it's a four-year intensive training program, and I'm very heavily involved in this iteration of it. So I've not had much time for reflection. I've been in the doing pattern, but that my commitment to this year is to not be in the doing pattern so much. And I thought that it would be so interesting to them to mention the year of, and a number of the people in the training program also chose to make this a year of something. And for those of you who were not here last week, the idea is that we make some theme, some aspect of change in our lives, or some aspect of caring in our lives, or some aspect of understanding, or some aspect of discipline, to be a central organizing principle for a year of our lives, a central organizing principle. So last week, one of the people that were here in Marin Sangha, this person came to me and said, I'm going to make this the year of discipline. And for this person, that was the right thing to be doing. Someone else, let's see if I can remember this right. Someone else, I think it was the year of self-caring. It was something to do with caring. I think it was self-caring. This kind of a suggestion is a big idea kind of suggestion that we deal with our lives not from the particular narrative, or certainly not from the particular stimulation of any particular moment or day or week, but rather in an arc way to say that we can take our time as a whole and in an overarching way focus it in a way that brings more results than just being reactive to whatever's going on in the moment. It actually empowers a responsive relationship to some aspect of our lives. And I mention this again because I want to really encourage this and for you to get to gain some familiarity with how you can deal with your life and its larger aspects in a way that's personal to you, but that employs these universal characteristics that the Buddha teaches of non-clinging, non-grasping, of loving-kindness, of compassion, and so forth, that we can actually deal with ourselves in these ways and without always being submerged in, well, this happened and that happened. In the course of this last few days, I have a family of Arjun member that's going through a very difficult time and not a very wise time for them. They're not acting in a very wise way. And the helplessness one feels when someone's doing something that's quite self-destructive, could end up in a death, is not the helplessness. What does one do? One can be lost in that helplessness, or accept that helplessness and accept the not knowing and continue the caring and do what one can, but not then be lost in this particular large event arising in my life, but far more larger in my family member's life. But the large event arising, but to not then be swept away from the over arc of what one comes about. If you don't do that, you get lost over and over again in so many things that there is to grieve for, to worry about, to wish that it were otherwise, to try to understand what seems understandable. The event in France this week, the killing of those many school children the week before. There's so many things on a large scale, on a personal scale, that there is to be distracted in, to be worried about, to fret about, to be outraged about. And it's not that we shouldn't grieve, it's not that we shouldn't be outraged in the events in Ferguson, the events in Long Island. It's not that we should not care about those things. It's that we not lose our overarching purpose. Because when we do, we then become part of the problem rather than part of the solution. So as we grow in understanding, as we grow in choice to choose non-suffering over suffering, we become wiser, more compassionate, and more able to be effective in whatever way each of us personally feels is a responsive, caring way to be, a wise way to be. One of the things that we worked on this week is the process of being in groups, and the process, it's always in groups of projection, where we can project on another some characteristic of ourselves. And then the phenomena of transference and counter-transference. And I thought I would mention these tonight, and we'll see how this goes, because well, as you'll see in the film next week, so much of our struggle has to do with the way our minds make a story out of our experience. And so what is projection? Projection is when there is, and the way it's defined, you can certainly have your own understanding of it and your own definition of it. But the way I define projection is when there are feelings that for whatever reason we cannot own in ourselves, we project them onto another person. In any group, this is happening all the time, both with those, all of us together, and then towards those who are leading a particular group. Here in Marin Sangha, we're all in this together, and then there are people who play various leadership roles, and there will be projection onto them. Those projections, they don't belong exclusively to the people who are playing leadership roles. We often project on one another. You can think of times in your grade school, in your high school, and whatever point, the people in your neighborhood, the person you don't know down the street that you may have, that person's nasty. They're always gruff. And so we could be projecting onto that person our own gruffness, our own bad mood stuff. And we can likewise be being projected on by that neighbor or the person across the street that we think really has only positive feelings for us, but there's something about themselves they project onto us. This is inevitable, can't be helped. It is part of life. However, mindfulness can help us see when we're doing that, can help us understand when someone else is doing that to us and we not take it so personally either way. And gradually, in many situations, if we are projecting onto another, we can take back our projections. And far more difficult to develop, we learn somewhat skills to be able to help someone take back their own projections towards us. That's much harder and much more difficult to do, and invites all sorts of delusion when we think that someone's projecting onto us, but we're projecting onto them, but they're projecting onto us, da-da-da. Often, to all of this, it can be quite a challenging situation. So what gets projected? What gets projected sometimes is our unease, that we have an unease about something, and we project that unease onto the other person. We can be feeling anger, and anger gets projected onto that other person. We can have a certain capacity, but we are not in touch with that capacity in us. We don't have confidence in that capacity in us, and so we project that capacity onto another. We're not yet able to own that in ourselves, this wonderful ability that we have to do X or Y, to organize or whatever it may be. So we project it onto another. When I was in high school, I was quite alienated. I'm sure I'm the only person in the room that was alienated in high school. But I was quite alienated and just had almost no way of relating in a social situation my last 2 years in high school. I'd sort of lost it. I worked most of the time when I wasn't in school. I worked until 9 or sometimes 10 o'clock at night, and there was all sorts of things I was doing that fostered that, because when school was over, I'd grab a city bus and go to my job and so forth. And so I got more and more alienated. And by the time of my senior year, I projected that there were to others a capacity to organize, that others were leaders, that they were in charge, and that I was not one of those people. And I just assumed that. I wasn't complaining about it. I just said, that kind of person is the leader, and I'm not that kind of person. And then at the very, very last of my senior year in college, and in the summer immediately afterwards, two or three situations came up when I was with those kind of leaders, and they didn't lead. They did not lead. And I led. And I was so stunned. First of all, why didn't they lead? Because it was obvious what needed to be done in each of these situations. One involved someone who was quite seriously injured in an accident. And the leaders didn't lead. As a matter of fact, in that instance, they sort of tried to flee the scene. And I really just stepped right up. And I don't know what was more surprising, that the leaders didn't lead, which I had projected on them, or the fact that I led. It was a complete surprise to me that I had this ability and that I would, from somewhere, do it. That was the beginning of me taking back some capacity that I had, that I had never owned in myself. Now that's a positive trait, and I told you a story like that deliberately because it's so easy that in our sort of pop psychology society, where we're all psychologists of some kind, we tend to think of all projections as negative, but quite often it can be that we're projecting onto others our positive capacity. But likewise, our insecurities of something's not going right, we can project onto others. And we can also, and one way that we can project onto others is a kind of, when there's a group unease, one person can be the recipient of the feeling of that unease. That unease can be projected onto one person from a group. This doesn't feel good when this happens. I have had this happen to me a number of times, so that I am really qualified to report this as an experience. And then there's always this question of how much of it is mine? How much is it mine to carry? And can't really know sometimes, you know? It doesn't feel like all of it's yours, maybe, but some of it may be yours. That's certainly how I've worked with it myself, is that how that works. And one of the funny things about it is because I've been a leader now for so many decades, when things work well, people sort of claim all the credit just fine for themselves. But if things aren't going well, They need someone to say, well, this is why things aren't going well. And in quite a few situations, I've been that person that was volunteered to be the recipient of the projections. And, well, this is, you're the reason that something's not going well. And for a number of years, that bothered me. But it seldom bothers me now when that happens. It doesn't. May be true, may not be true, to some degree true, not true. Who knows all of that? And how important is that? You know, how important is it? And so as we grow in our mindfulness and our self-compassion, very important is self-compassion, and then the compassion for others, then that kind of organizing becomes less important. Likewise, and we spent quite a bit of time on this in our teacher training, because they are going to get a lot of what's called transference and counter-transference experiences. Transference is when there is, if I may remind you of your brother or your cousin or your uncle or this neighbor you had, you know, that was from the Appalachian Mountains a long time ago, something about me evokes a feeling in you. And you ascribe to me some of those feelings that you had towards another person. That's a transference of feelings from one person, a story about, so on, from one person to another. You know, the thing about this transference of feeling is that so often it is unconscious. So therefore we don't really realize we're doing it. So it's very difficult to take responsibility for something that we don't know we're doing. In the movie you'll see next week, you'll see some wonderful examples of transference and then people working it out. I mean, really inspiring versions of that. Counter-transference is when you're in a situation where you're in a leadership role or you're in some way playing some sort of role that it's not just someone's transferring onto you, but you have this transference back towards them based on what their transference onto you evokes something in you. And so it's like a loop that way. For me, there's also being in any kind of a teacher role or leadership role or even an authority role where I'm the customer in a store or something, and there's a the person in the store is, there's something that I've evoked in them, and I could see it in me. But there's also a situation where you can be in a leadership role and you are triggered by the other person because they remind you of someone having nothing to do with them, that the loop starts with you. And this is one of the things that I really emphasized in the training, is that oftentimes for teachers, it's easy to not notice that something about that person, or even some gesture or something, can have that. Particularly around something like trauma, there can be some gesture that is so strong that it evokes that. Or a look, or a particular laughter. So many different things can do that. And so as we learn to be with others, we get interested in this projection and transference and counter-transference to the degree that we are able to own our own reactive mind as best we're able. So we're interested in, not in judging ourselves, but in discernment, and discernment for purposes of caring and for wisdom. So when it's not a who shot John kind of experience, but, oh, what can I do to reduce the suffering in this situation? This being the end of your first year as an independent organization, you can look back and see all of these things that were at play at various points. You can look back through the 17 years and all of our experience together about all of these different things, including just the setup sessions, the setup sessions. There's how many dramas would you say there's been about the maybe 1,000 dramas around just the setup and every other aspect of this. When we own it, when we make it normal, we stay included. When we don't make it normal, then we run into trouble. The story I was telling you last week about the Buddha at Kasambi, there was this sutta master did something that from the point of view of the person who was the master of the precepts, it was something wrong. And the precept master says to the sutta master, "That was wrong, you need to confess this." And the sutta master goes, "That's not master," goes, "That's not wrong at all." Not his area, mind you, of expertise. His expertise was sutta. He's going, "No, I'm a sutta master. I wouldn't have done that, and I didn't intend that." And off they go into this argument. So the Buddha hears about this and calls each of them in and says, you know, to have a harmonious community, we don't have these kinds of arguments. You need to resolve this. And so they leave individually, and nothing gets resolved. In fact, it gets worse because each of the people that are associated with each, the sutta master and the precept master, they all start arguing, defending the person that's their teacher. And so it escalates. So the Buddha hears about all this, and he asks that the whole symbol of monks and nuns come together. And he appears before them to speak. And before he gets the chance to speak, this one monk stands up and says, you know, "We don't really need you to do this. We're adults. We can handle this conflict on our own. So why don't you just continue with your practice and we'll take care of this." The Buddha stays silent and just leaves the assembly, goes back to his little kuti, takes his alms bowl and walks out. Tells nobody that he's leaving. He just leaves. And so they're left for some period of time to work with this. We'll come back to them. And he leaves and wanders for a period of time on his own. And then he goes to another place where he gives another gathering of monks and nuns and monastics, and he engages in a teaching about harmony there and what is harmony and what's skillful for that. And then he wanders some more, and then he ends up in yet a third place where Ananda finds him and says, "You know, we've really missed you." And the Buddha says, or something, just acknowledgement. And Ananda was his chief attendant, and he says because it's now been over a year, and they say the things got no. First he says, "They asked me where you were gone, and I said I didn't know." And they said, "Well, let's go find him." And I said, "No, if he left in silence, then he did not want to be found. He wanted to go on his own." And Ananda says, "Well, things got much worse," mm-hmm. And they got much, much worse, and to the point that they decided they had to have your intervention in this. And so we've been out searching for you, and I came here because I knew you would come to this particular monastery sooner or later. So I've just been here waiting. And so then gradually the word goes out, and they all come and. They go through this process, and then the Buddha creates this process of reconciliation for members. And it starts out, I didn't bring the sutta, I didn't know I was going to go this far in this till I got here tonight. So I didn't bring the sutta to take through you, and I'll bring the sutta about the way the Buddha talks about these different steps of reconciliation. But plenty of time is given to the reconciliation. And then at the end, it's called covering mud with straw, where there's a sense of the elders in this particular community, whatever community it is, they say, well, this is the way to resolve this. And everybody agrees, because everyone's been given a full hearing and all. And then everybody rows the boat in the same direction after that point. And in fact, in this particular instance, the precept master and said, you were right. I did create an error, and I want to confess, just as you had told me a year and a half ago to confess. I now want to confess. And then the precept master said, and I spoke harshly, and I made it hard for you to confess because I spoke harshly, and I ask your forgiveness. And so they each did in the monastic community, they have these days that are designated for taking account for saying, I was unskillful in this way. And so they had one such day, and each of them took responsibility for it, in what way they were unskillful, and it went from there. So, in the same way with our family members, we can really see with our family members, with our friends, that we can project our feelings onto them, that we can have a kind of transference where in relation to something that they're really good at doing that we're not good at doing, we can really transfer, there could be something about them that reminds them of us of some other situation, some other person, and in that area we have a big transference, and it can be very unskillful. And likewise going the other way in a kind of a counter-transference. And with family, with friends, with people at work, what we use is the mindfulness, and we use it in terms of, are we causing harm or not causing harm in a situation? And that is our measuring device. One way of looking at this is to see if you are ever treating a person as an object. And what I mean by this is in those situations where we are not treating another person as an independent person, but they become an object to meeting a need of ours. So that need might be an emotional need, it might be a sexual need, it might be a kind of status need where we need to make them less so we can feel like more. But that where there is some feeling of that we have moved them into being less than the full complex person that's a mystery. And this is a big sign of that. Sometimes that feeling can be one of, there can be a kind of a relief that doesn't, when you really notice you've had an encounter with someone and you feel relieved, something, you're relieved in some way, like some pressure was relieved, but you don't feel so good inside. So there's a relief, but that relief is not to be trusted. Sometimes it's a kind of feeling of discharge, that there was like something had been built up and now it's discharged, but it doesn't feel harmonious. Again, that's a sign that something's off in this regard. Or there is a sense of, I know this is the one I've struggled the most with, where there's some sense of one's gotten something one wants, but it doesn't feel so good to have it, kind of feeling. I know there's not an easy way to say that. These are little signs of that we're involved in this transference, counter-transference, or this projection process. I sometimes call that a kind of pleasure thing, but a kind of like a false pleasure or shallow pleasure feeling that's really not satisfying. And again, none of us are going to be perfect in this. We can take it out. We can be nasty to the waiter or waitress that brought our food when they didn't prepare that food and it wasn't what we had ordered. We could be nasty to that wait person for no reason. The other night, I don't go out to eat very much anymore. I used to go out every single meal for years, and now I almost never go out. But the other night, I was out in a restaurant, and I don't eat meat, and haven't had any meat or chicken or anything like that since 1983. Mm-hmm. So it's a long time. And I ordered a dish that had bacon in it, and I said, "Is it any trouble to take out the bacon?" And the waiter said, "No, absolutely not. People ask for this all the time. This is Marin." True enough. And I said, "Good." And I saw the waiter write down, "No bacon." And when the meal came back, I was very engaged in an intense conversation. So did the little food prayer that I want to teach you sometime that I do. I don't know if I'd call it a prayer, but a ritual of recognition, recognition of the food. And then we ate the food. We started eating the food, and then at some point I realized that something's wrong here. And they had, of course, put the bacon in the food, and my stomach was immediately, because this had been, and how many decades since I've had anything like that in my belly. And so I waited till the waiter was back to say this to. And he took it so personally, like he had done something wrong. And I kept saying, "No, you didn't do anything wrong. This was just an accident that happened." There was a time in my life, many decades ago, when I would have taken it out on the waiter. Because why didn't you check, waiter, to make sure it wasn't right? And you could say the waiter should have checked, right? Or someone should have checked. Someone, it shouldn't be like this. Mistakes shouldn't happen. How many times did we do this in our life? Someone should have done this. But how many times were we that someone, you know? Or someone we really care about that we know is well-intentioned was that someone. Well, this something was stored that made one of these get wrinkled or something got lost. We can always find, for someone should have. So is that really the way we want to react to the world? There are times and places when we've really got to be part of bringing about change in an organization or in our government, the way we treat other countries or people. There's times for a certain active movement of change, of seeking justice, of just seeking more wisdom. And the way a family system is operating and the way a service is being provided by a store or a physician or whatever that is. There's times for that. But to be interested in what happens. And many times we go into a situation where we're in a bad mood and we project it on the person that's frustrating us. Or for some reason, again, unconscious to us, that person is reminding us of someone else that was mean to us or unkind to us, and this person's doing their job, but we transfer onto that person all of those feelings. Again, we're not going to completely stop that, but we can have choices around that. So this commitment to coming together in harmony, meeting in harmony, and parting in harmony. We're not going to be perfect at it, but it is part of our mindful practice. Why? Because when we fail to have harmony as our goal, then we are more likely to create suffering for ourselves and another in this way. It is quite a challenge to do this. It's quite a challenge when one's in a leadership role or in a role of responsibility, like all of these teachers in training are going to be in quite a strong position where they're going to receive a lot of projection and they're going to be involved in a lot of transference and potential counter-transference situation. One needs to become mindful of that. Every single one of us needs to do this, no matter your age. One of the things that that's painful for me is to see when people are at the latter stages of their life being so unkind to the people who are taking care of them. Mm-hmm. Every year I do a day long at Spirit Rock that everybody's invited in the community who's a care provider to come. And many of you in here come volunteer to help in one way or the other, either as assisting me in the day long or assisting Spirit Rock in that day long. And so we as a Sangha have somewhat been putting those day longs on care providers together for well over 10 years now. And one of the things that they like to talk about is the people, the care providers, is when they're really being mistreated by those that that need care. And it's very painful. Just very recently, a member of our Sangha was in a situation where they were stepped in to take care of someone using a particular skill set they have, and the person receiving the care was treated them with such gratitude. But the people around the person that was being cared for, the family members as it were really unkind to this person who was just voluntarily helping take care of someone. And when I hear this kind of thing, I'm just so sorry for everyone. It's not looking for someone to blame. It's seeing the suffering in these situations. And in this instance, there was a lot of wisdom by the care provider who's heard all of this before and understood all the things that happens. But in other times, it is the recipient of the care themselves, as in my family member's situation, who is right now, who is not being very kind to this very generous amount of time that's being given, but not being able to be generous right now with that. And there's, again, for us to then have ill will towards someone, then we perpetuate the cycle, do you see? We perpetuate the cycle. So how do we break these cycles of projection, of transference, of counter-transference, seeking someone to blame, acting out frustration? How do we cease to contribute to that? How do we break the cycle of that? This is a question that we each can carry forward this week and on and on in our lives. How do we stop participating in that? What is our motivation? Our motivation is to be able to meet situations with compassion and wisdom, to meet situations with loving kindness, to not choose to create suffering when there is any choice. This is our possibility. It's a mundane subject, you know. It's not like, oh, and then there was this, there arose the third jhana, or so forth and so forth. Later on in the week, another point in the week of the training, we were talking at one point about supportive and unsupportive consciousness. And I really wanted to do this tonight. I thought, I'll just do that. It's a very subtle teaching, you know. I was aware that most people go, what is he talking about? But it's really interesting to me, and so I really wanted to come in and talk about it, but very, very subtle to do. But in fact, in making this is a Dharma in daily life oriented Sangha, what we talked about tonight, that's what makes the difference in terms of suffering in daily life right now. So we won't want to confuse the Dharma as something that only happens when we're sitting on the cushion or we're listening to some esoteric talk about the construction of consciousness. It's the heart's response, moment to moment. Thank you for listening. May we close our eyes. Projection onto another is unskillful. Is there any room to take back that projection? there's no room to take back the projection, can you hold your aspiration that you would seek, if you have choice, you will take back the projection? This is the inclining of the heart. That's the edge of practice, not what happens. Different things happen when we practice. We stay connected to the aspiration, to the intention as well. Thinking of someone or some situation where you feel projected upon. Again, current if possible. If there's nothing current, something that's happened in the past that's still alive for you. Is it possible that in some small way you can let loose of your reactivity to having been the recipient of this projection? Where you're willing to carry it with more compassion for yourself and for the other person. Again, it could be a family member, it could be at work, it could be in some other kind of organization, it could be in here. Imagining carrying the projection with just a little more kindness towards yourself, towards the other. We don't have to continue a cycle. And likewise now, turning to a kind of transference, where someone in your life right now, that there's a charge there because they remind you in some way, some association of someone in your past. Or someone that's in your present, that's maybe the person at work uses a certain phrase that your wife or husband use, and in an area that irritates you, and that person at work uses that phrase, and you find yourself not liking that person because of your situation at home around that area. Any kind of transference of feeling that you might be aware of. How does it feel to even explore this? Can you have a tender attitude towards yourself? Yeah, who said I was supposed to be perfect? Where are you transferring? Where might you be transferring? Is there a pattern of some kind, that some clue? Can you at least commit to saying, I wish to be more aware of this phenomena of transference of feeling? Likewise, with counter-transference, where in some situation of responsibility or something's come up where you feel as though someone has in some way But this, it's something in you, by their transferring onto you, something that's not yours, and then that triggered something in you. Again, in present if possible, if not the past. If it's the past, could you let go of the past another step, here and now? One Sangha member who was put in charge of a project, and one person on that project thought all these terrible things about them. And it so triggered this person's sense of always being criticized, and did not handle it well. Could you let that go? Resting in the knowing gives us the room. We know that this is happening. We know our intention to not cause suffering, to have loving kindness. And we know that this well, this ground, be the nourishment, be the water that washes this away, be the ground in which it's released onto, be the wind that blows through and cleans this out. The knowing itself being the fire that burns it up. Whatever image works for you. Reflecting for one more moment on how you may be feeding and supporting someone's projection onto another. Meaning to be a good friend or a good partner, spouse. You support a projection that you actually know is only a projection. And yet you go along with it. Or you witness a transference and you've not spoken gently in some way. You know, this sounds an awfully lot like some feelings you had towards your mother, that is this person really like your mother? Or have you gone along well-intentioned but not with wisdom? Letting all this go. This knowing space remains. This capacity to know, to be mindful. Not just that there's moments of consciousness, but that we know what those consciousnesses are. This is the mindfulness. And we know this. Faith.